capacity to concentrate full attention on one subject at a time. The jack of all trades is seldom good at any. Concentrated effort gives one power that can be attained in no other way. 25. The habit of learning from mistakes, one's own and the mistakes of others. 26. Willingness to accept the full responsibility of the mistakes of one's subordinates, without trying to pass the buck. Nothing destroys one's capacity of leadership quicker than the habit of shifting responsibilities to others. 27. The habit of adequately recognizing the merits of others, especially when they have done exceptionally good work. Men will often work harder for friendly recognition of their merits than they will for money alone. The successful leader goes out of his way to give credit to his subordinates. A pat on the back denotes confidence. 28. The habit of applying the golden rule principle in all human relationships. The Sermon on the Mount remains a classic for all time as a sound rule of human relationship. It inspires cooperation that can be had in no other way. 29. A positive mental attitude at all times. No one likes a grouchy, skeptical person who seems to be at outs with the world in general. Such a man will never become an able leader. 30. The habit of assuming full responsibility for each and every task one undertakes, regardless of who actually does the work. Perhaps this quality of leadership should have headed the entire list, and it would have if the qualities of successful leadership had been listed in the order of their importance. 31. A keen sense of values. The ability to evaluate in the light of sound judgment without being guided by emotional factors. The habit of putting first things first. All these qualities of leadership are capable of development and application by any person of average intelligence.
From your analysis of the qualities of leadership, it appears that successful leadership is largely a state of mind or mental attitude.
Leadership is not entirely a question of the proper mental attitude, although that is an important factor. The successful leader must possess definite knowledge of his life's purpose and work. Men do not like to follow a leader who obviously knows less about his job than they do.
Are all men capable of becoming successful leaders?
Not by any means. You would be surprised to know how few men there are who aspire to become leaders. Most men do not wish to assume the responsibilities of leadership. Others lack the ambition to put forth the extra effort that must go into successful leadership.
What is the best method for inspiring men to become leaders in their chosen occupations?
As I have already stated, men do things because of a motive. Leadership can best be inspired by planting in a man's mind a definite motive that forces him to acquire the qualities of leadership. The profit motive is one of the most popular. When men make up their minds to acquire wealth or attain success, they usually begin to exercise their privileges of personal initiative along lines that develop leadership.
Then you believe it would be inadvisable to discourage the desire for personal wealth?
Let me answer you in this way. This country is recognized the world over as having more leaders in industry and business than any other nation. These leaders developed their qualities of leadership in response to their desire for wealth. Obviously, anything which kills off this desire would strike at the very roots of our national resources, a major portion of which consists of the creative ability of the men who manage industry.
Would you say that the desire for private riches is the only motive that has inspired so many Americans to develop the qualities of leadership?
Not at all. We have many able leaders in America whose major motive is that of building and creating. The pride of personal achievement is a strong factor in the American way of life. Beyond the point at which a man acquires economic security, he begins to become motivated largely by his pride of achievement. One man can eat only one meal at a time, wear one suit of clothes at a time, and sleep in one bed. After he acquires security and connection with these necessities, he begins to think in terms of desire for public acclaim. He wishes to become recognized as a successful person. There may be a few men with the hoarding instinct of the miser, but a majority of the successful men of America think in terms of the use they can give money instead of endeavoring to accumulate money for the sake of having it. It has been this desire for self-expression through the use of money that has made America the great industrial nation that it is.
I take it, then, that the possession of great riches by one individual may be either a blessing or a curse, according to the use he makes of his riches.
That is my belief precisely. Take John D. Rockefeller as an example. He has accumulated a vast fortune, but every dollar of it is at work, developing, extending, expanding some form of useful industrial, business, or philanthropic service. Through the use of his money, he provides employment to many thousands of men, but it still serves a higher purpose. Through the Rockefeller Foundation, the Rockefeller fortune is serving mankind in scores of ways that have nothing whatsoever to do with further profits for Mr. Rockefeller. His fortune is fighting disease and helping to suppress the enemies of mankind in other ways. It is helping to uncover useful knowledge through scientific research, the benefits of which will extend to generations yet unborn.
Then you would say that the people of America are better off because of the manner in which Mr. Rockefeller has exercised his personal initiative in the accumulation of riches.
Not only the people of the United States, but the people of the entire world are benefiting by his initiative and his acquisitive spirit. What this country needs is not fewer men like Mr. Rockefeller, but more of his type. Take James J. Hill as another example. Through his personal initiative, he built the great transcontinental railroad system that opened up millions of acres of unused lands and brought the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans within easily accessible proximity to each other. It would be difficult to estimate the wealth which, by the exercise of his personal initiative, this one man has added to the riches of America. It probably amounts to billions of dollars. The private fortune he accumulated for his services is as nothing compared to the wealth his activities added to the nation as a whole.
You might include yourself in that category also, Mr. Carnegie. Would you mind estimating the wealth your own personal initiative has added to the country?
I much prefer to speak of the achievements of others who have done more than I. But if you insist on an answer, let me call your attention to the impetus that has been given to the building of skyscrapers since my associates uncovered more economical and better methods of producing steel. You know, of course, that the modern skyscraper would be an impossibility without the use of the steel frame. The skyscraper would also be an economic impossibility if steel were as expensive as it was when I entered the business of manufacturing steel. We have given the country a better product than any it knew before we entered the business of making steel, and we have brought prices down to where steel can be substituted for the less satisfactory products of wood and other metals of less durability. When I first entered the steel business, steel, such as it was, sold for around $130 per ton. We brought it down to around $20 per ton. Moreover, we so improved the quality that steel now serves scores of uses for which it was not suited until we improved it.
Was your major motive that of making money, Mr. Carnegie?
No. My major motive always has been that of making men more useful to themselves and to others. As you may have heard, I have had the privilege of making millionaires of more than 40 men, most of them men who began working with me as ordinary laborers. But the money these men accumulated is not the important thing I wish to stress. In helping them to accumulate money, I helped them to become a great asset to this nation. By inspiring them to exercise their own initiative, I started them to rendering useful service that has contributed richly to the development of the great industrial system of America. You see, therefore, that these men became more than owners of riches. They became intelligent users of riches, and as such, they provided employment for many thousands of men. As I have already mentioned, wealth consists in material things and human experience properly mixed. The more important part of the mixture is brains, experience, personal initiative, the desire to build and create. Without these qualities, money would be useless. Understand this truth and you will have a better knowledge of the nature of our American riches. We are a rich nation because we have a great number of pioneers whose pride of personal achievement has enticed them to exercise their right of individual initiative in all forms of business and industrial activity. These men may think they were motivated by the desire for personal riches, but the truth is that they were influenced by the much greater desire for personal achievement. Regardless of the motives by which they were actuated, they have helped to convert a vast wilderness known formerly as the land of the Indians into the world's richest and most progressive nation. This could not have been accomplished without the free, voluntary exercise of the personal initiative of the men who did the job.
What part has the American form of government served in the development of American industry, Mr. Carnegie?
A very necessary part indeed. If you will read the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, you will see clearly that the men who wrote those profound documents clearly intended to surround the people of America with every conceivable right and opportunity for the free exercise of personal initiative. Under no other form of government do men receive such definite encouragement to exercise their personal initiative.
Then you see no reason for changing our form of government.
Not unless we find still better ways of influencing men to take possession of their own minds and use their abilities on their own initiative. Our form of government is not perfect, but it is the best the world has yet discovered. It provides far greater liberties and privileges of the use of personal initiative than the majority of men are using intelligently. Why change it until the people of America catch up with it by using the opportunities it provides? Tinkering with things that serve satisfactorily is one trait that gets men into difficulty. This is one form of personal initiative that should be discouraged. It comes under the heading of meddlesome curiosity. If a man has good health, he should go about his business and not interfere with nature by experimenting with cures of diseases with which he does not suffer. However, there are some who do not follow this rule. They are known as hypochondriacs, and they are always suffering with imaginary illness. We are in a healthy economic condition in this country. We have vastly greater undeveloped resources than any we are using. Let us not experiment with our economic system, but rather let us make more intelligent use of our present system, to the end that we may make better uses of our great resources. Nations that are always experimenting with their systems of government and their economic systems are engaged in revolutions and counter-revolutions most of their time. No small part of our success here in America is due to the spirit of harmonious relationship existing between the states of the Union. That harmony is the direct result of our form of government, which wisely provides an incentive for harmony among the people. In union, there is strength. This is true of business and industrial groups, the same as it is in the relationship between the states.
What do you believe to be the greatest possible evil that might curtail the success of the American people as a whole?
Anything that would weaken the spirit of harmony between the people. Our unity of purpose is our greatest national asset. It is vastly more important than all our natural resources. For without this, we would become the victims of any greedy nation that might wish to take our natural resources away from us. We fought a tragic war among our own people to maintain our national unity. While memories of this war linger in the minds of some, now we all recognize that a separation of the states would have meant the beginning of our disintegration. And I might well add that the greatest evil that can overtake an industry or a business is that which disturbs the harmonious working relationship between those engaged in it. Business succeeds through the friendly cooperation of those engaged in it. Personal initiative is a power for good only when men combine their experience and ability and work toward a common end in a spirit of harmony and understanding.
Then you do not look with favor on those who make it their business to stir up strife, hatred, and envy among men who are engaged in the operation of the American industrial system?
No, this is a form of personal initiative which may help some, but it destroys the rights of many. In our own industry, I have never had any misunderstanding with those who work for me, except that which was inspired by professional agitators who profit by disturbing human relationships. This is the worst of all forms of personal initiative. How could I have had any misunderstanding with men who, down to the humblest worker, knew that the door of opportunity was wide open day and night to those who wished to earn more by making themselves worth more? The man who helps wage earners to rise from day labor to become millionaires, as I have done whenever I had the opportunity, is not likely to have any misunderstanding with his men if he is left alone to deal with them on the basis of free enterprise.
But, Mr. Carnegie, are there not some employers who do not take such a constructive attitude regarding their relationship with their employees? Are there not some employers who greedily clamor for more than their share of what their business produces?
Yes, there are some such. There always have been. There will always be men of greed. But they do not last. Competition soon eliminates them. That is one of the benefits of the system of free enterprise under which we operate in America. Here an employer must make good or make room, and he cannot make good at the expense of his employees. His competitors see to that.
When and under what circumstances should one begin to exercise personal initiative? Is there not such a thing as favorable circumstances under which one may exercise initiative profitably, exactly right, while other circumstances make it advisable for one to remain inactive?
The time to begin using personal initiative is immediately following one's definite decision as to what one wishes to accomplish. The time to begin is right then. If the plan chosen turns out to be weak, it can be changed for a better one. But any sort of plan is better than procrastination. The universal evil of the world is procrastination, the terrible habit people have of waiting for the time to begin something to be just right. It causes more failures than all the weak plans of the world.
But shouldn't one consult others and get their opinions before beginning important plans?
Opinions are like the sands of the desert, and most of them are about as slippery. Everyone has an opinion about practically everything, but most of them are unworthy of trust. The man who hesitates because he wants the opinion of others before he begins to exercise his personal initiative usually winds up by doing nothing. Of course, there are exceptions to this rule. There are times when the counsel and advice of others are absolutely essential for success. But if you refer to idle opinions of bystanders, let them alone. Avoid them as you would an epidemic of disease. For that is exactly what idle opinions are, a disease. Everyone has a flock of them, and most people hand them out freely without being asked. If you want an opinion on which you can rely, consult the man who is known to be an authority on the subject in connection with which you seek an opinion. Pay him for his counsel, but avoid free opinions because they are generally worth exactly what one pays for them. I recall quite clearly what some acquaintances of mine said when they heard I was planning to cut the price of steel to $20 a ton. "You'll go broke," they shouted. They gave me free advice without my seeking it. I passed it by and went ahead with my plans. Steel came down to $20 a ton. When Henry Ford announced that he would give the people a dependable automobile for less than $1,000, they shouted, "He'll go broke!" But Ford went ahead with his plans, and one day he will be the dominating factor in one of America's greatest industries, and he'll not go broke. When Columbus announced that he would sail his little boats across an uncharted ocean and discover a new route to India, the doubting Thomases cried out, "He's crazy! He'll never come back!" But he did come back. When Copernicus announced he had invented an instrument with which he had revealed hidden worlds never before seen by the human eye, these same free opinion fellows hooted, "Heretic, put him to the torch!" They actually wanted to burn him for daring to use his own initiative. When Alexander Graham Bell announced he had invented a telephone with which people could talk to one another at long distance by the use of wires, the unbelievers yelled, "Poor Alex has gone crazy." But Bell went ahead with his idea and perfected it, although the time did not appear to be just right. And you'll have your turn with these free opinion boys who spend their time trying to discourage men from using their own initiative. You'll hear them cry out, "He can't do it! He can't give the world a philosophy of individual achievement because no one has ever done it before." But if you take my advice, you will go right ahead and back your judgment on your own initiative. When you succeed, as succeed you will, the world will crown you with glory and lay its treasures at your feet, but not until you have taken the risk and have proved your ideas sound. Don't become discouraged because other people may tell you the time is not right. The time is always right for the man who knows what he wants and goes to work to get it. The world needs a philosophy of individual achievement. It has always needed such a philosophy. Go ahead and supply that need, no matter how long it takes or what sacrifices you may have to make to do the job. Do the job the best you can, and you'll learn from first-hand experience that these calamity howlers are nothing but a bunch of disappointed human beings who are suffering with an inferiority complex because they have neglected to use their own initiative.
That was quite a speech, Mr. Carnegie, and I take it for granted that you meant it mostly for me.
Yes, I meant it for you, and through your efforts I hope it will serve the yet unborn generations long after I shall have passed on. The world needs men who have the courage to act on their own initiative. Moreover, men of this type write their own price tag, and the world willingly pays it. The world willingly rewards men of initiative. The privilege of personal initiative is an important part of the American way of life. But the privilege is worth nothing if it is not exercised. What we need most here in the United States is a continuous sales campaign for the sole purpose of keeping the American people inspired with a desire to take advantage of the opportunities available for the accumulation of riches. The government should conduct a continuous campaign designed entirely to bring to the attention of the people the nature and scope of the opportunities available to them.
Then you believe there are still enough opportunities for individual success in the United States to go around to all the people?
Yes, there is an opportunity to match the ambition and the ability of every person in the United States. But opportunity will not hunt the man. The order must be reversed through organized individual endeavor. The greatest opportunities will be available to those who are the most capable of organizing and directing their own efforts.
Some may not understand what is meant by the term organized individual endeavor. Would you define your understanding of this principle?
The principle of organized individual endeavor consists of very definite procedure through which an individual may promote himself into whatever station he desires or acquire whatever material things he wishes. The steps to be taken are these. A. Choice of a definite purpose or objective. B. Creation of a plan for the attainment of the objective. C. Continuous action in carrying out the plan. D. Alliance with those who will cooperate in carrying out the plan. E. Moving at all times on one's own initiative. Organized individual endeavor might be briefly described as planned action. Any action based on a definite plan has a better chance of success than effort of an unorganized, haphazard nature, such as that in which the majority of people engage. Able leadership without organized individual endeavor is an impossibility. The two major points of difference between a leader and a follower are these. 1. The leader carefully plans his efforts, and 2. He moves on his own initiative without being told to do so. If you wish to find a potential leader, look around until you find a man who makes his own decisions, plans his own work, and carries out his plans on his own initiative. In such a man, you will see the major requirements for leadership. This is the type of man who pioneered in American industry. And to him we owe the credit for the great American industrial system, which is the envy of the world.
What about the quality of genius? Aren't the leaders in industry and business blessed with some form of genius which most people do not possess, Mr. Carnegie?
Now you are talking about a fallacy that has deceived more people than any other mistaken idea. The word genius is badly overworked. It is generally used to explain successful achievement because most people do not take the time to dig in and find out how men succeed. Personally, I do not know what a genius is. I have never seen one. But I have seen many successful men who are called geniuses. Analysis of the cause of their success would show that they are only average men who have discovered and applied certain rules which enabled them to get from where they started to where they wished to go. Every normal person has within him the potentiality of that which we call genius, in one field of endeavor or another, depending upon the individual's preferences, his inborn traits of character, and his ambition. I would say that the nearest quality to genius that I could describe is an obsessional desire to do some one thing and do it well, plus the willingness to act on one's own initiative. From this point on, genius is only a matter of organized individual endeavor persistently carried out. The man who knows precisely what he wants and is determined to get it is about the nearest approach to that which some call genius that I can think of. Such a man has better than an average chance of success, and when he achieves success, the world is apt to look at him in the hour of triumph and attribute his achievements to what they believe to be genius.
But, Mr. Carnegie, doesn't the question of education enter into one's personal achievements? Isn't it true that the educated man has a better chance of success than the man who lacks education?
Many men are schooled, but few men are educated. An educated man is one who has learned how to use his mind so that he can get everything he desires without violating the rights of others. Education, therefore, comes from experience and use of the mind, and not merely from the acquisition of knowledge. Knowledge is of no value unless and until it is expressed in some form of useful service. Here is where the subject of personal initiative begins to prove its importance as an essential of success. To answer your question more specifically, an educated man has a better chance of success than one who is not educated, only in the event that he applies his education in the achievement of some definite objective. All too often, men rely upon their possession of knowledge to take the place of organized individual endeavor. They expect to be paid for that which they know instead of that which they do with their knowledge. This point is important. I have heard it said that some successful businessmen hesitate to employ men who have just graduated from college for the reason that many college graduates have too much they must unlearn before they become useful in the practical affairs of business. Speaking for myself, I would much prefer college-trained men for positions of responsibility, but I prefer them to come to me with an open mind, seeking more knowledge. I prefer those who have a sound knowledge of fundamentals rather than the tricks of the trade. I prefer those who know the difference between theory and practice. There is one great advantage that most college graduates have over those who lack this training, and it is the fact that college training helps one to organize his knowledge. Disorganized knowledge is of very little value.
Do you believe that alertness in the application of individual initiative is an inborn trait, that one has it or doesn't have it, according to the nature of his hereditary gifts?
My observation of people has forced me to the conclusion that personal initiative is largely based on personal desires and ambitions. The man who appears to have no individual initiative awakens and moves under his own initiative in a hurry when he becomes obsessed with some definite strong desire or purpose.
Would you say, then, that personal desire is the beginning of all individual achievements?
Yes, without a doubt. Definiteness of purpose is the result of desire. When a man's desires take on the proportion of an obsession, he usually begins to translate them into their physical equivalent through definiteness of purpose. Desire, therefore, is the starting point of all individual accomplishments. As far as I know, there is no impelling motive other than desire which inspires a man to move on his own initiative. Herein lies the secret of the influence some wives have over their husbands. When a man's wife desires riches or success, she may transplant that desire in the mind of her husband and cause him to move on it in a way that will enable him to succeed. I have often known of this happening. But in the last analysis, the desire for riches or success must become a definite motive on the part of the husband. The presence of a deeply seated desire in a man's mind has a tendency to stir him into action as nothing else can do.
Then you believe it is true, as one philosopher expressed it, that men's faults consist in low aim and not in the stars.
There is nothing that will take place of high aim. When a man sets his mind upon the achievement of a definite purpose, the powers of the universe appear to be on his side. He begins to make use of every available means to attain the object of his desires. The first thing that comes to his aid is his right to the exercise of individual initiative. Personal desires can be attained only by the exercise of personal initiative. If initiative takes on the form of organized individual endeavor, one's chances of success are greatly multiplied. When you analyze individual achievement in this manner, you learn quickly enough that no great achievement is possible without the application of organized individual endeavor. The use of this principle for the attainment of one's desires is not optional. It is imperative.
From your analysis of organized individual endeavor, I assume that this principle can be applied by the man with little schooling as well as by the man with extensive schooling. That it is not essentially a part of one's education in the popular interpretation of the meaning of the word education.
Lest you become confused on this point, let me make it clear that no man is educated, in the true meaning of that term, until he acquires a practical working knowledge of the principle of organized individual endeavor. Moving in an orderly, well-organized manner toward a definite end is precisely the procedure of an educated person. Go back to the definition of the word education and study it carefully. You will observe that the application of education leaves no alternative other than that of action based on organized individual endeavor. You might properly say that organized individual endeavor is education.
Mr. Carnegie, you said that the right time to begin a thing is when one makes up his mind to do it. Now, there must be some plan by which the public schools can be influenced to teach the philosophy of American achievement as soon as it has been published in textbook form. Therefore, I would like to know how you would go about introducing the philosophy in the public schools.
You have asked me to plan a job that will require many years for its completion, and many steps will have to be taken by you before the job is finished. Speaking in general terms, here is about the way you should proceed. First, you will have to publish the philosophy in popular textbook style and introduce it through individuals who desire to get ahead by the application of definite rules. If you are fortunate enough to find a publisher who will push the sale of your books, you will be able to do a pretty good job of distribution within 3 to 5 years. Second, you should begin training lecturers who will be able to teach the philosophy, so that when the time comes, you can supply the public schools with teachers. Meanwhile, before the public schools are ready for them, these lecturers can make a good living by organizing private classes. Third, you should organize your own private school, for the purpose of teaching the philosophy by the home study method, thereby placing yourself in a position to reach men and women in all parts of the country who want the philosophy. Fourth, you should have your publisher arrange for the translation of the philosophy into foreign languages, so it will be available to the mixed population of the United States who do not speak the English language. They need such a lesson in Americanism. This plan will also provide you with the means of spreading the philosophy in foreign countries. By the time you will have taken these steps, the general public will have become so success philosophy conscious that the public schools will become attracted to it. The time required to bring all this about may be as much as 10 years, depending, of course, upon what sort of leader you prove yourself to be.
In other words, it is up to me to put into practice that which I am offering to teach others. Is that the idea, Mr. Carnegie?
That is exactly the idea. You wouldn't think much of a doctor who refused to take his own medicine if he were ill. You must become your own best advertisement of the philosophy of American achievement by demonstrating that you can make it work for you.
Do you mean that I must convert the philosophy into great riches to prove its soundness?
It altogether depends upon what you mean by the term riches. There are many forms of riches, you know. As far as the accumulation of money is concerned, you can acquire all of that which you need and much more by applying the philosophy. But I wish to call your attention to a form of riches available to you which transcends by far any that money represents. The riches I have in mind are so stupendous in both quality and quantity that you may be surprised when I describe them. You may be still more surprised when I tell you that the riches I have in mind will not accrue to you alone, but they will become the property of the people of the world. If you recognize the far-flung possibilities of the picture I am about to draw for you, and follow the suggestions I offer, you may see the day when your riches will be vastly greater than any I possess. The Steel Master's Challenge to His Protégé. So, here is the picture. I warn you before I describe it that it will put you on the spot where your qualifications as a leader will be shown up for precisely what they are. But I will also be on the spot. For I selected you, out of all the men I know, as the man most capable of taking the philosophy of American achievement to the people. First, by the time you will have absorbed all the knowledge I shall pass on to you in connection with the philosophy of success, which I have gathered from experience, you will be in possession of the greater portion of my riches. Add to this the value of the riches you will acquire from other successful men, with whom I will arrange for their collaboration with you in the organization of the philosophy, and you will be in possession of the greater portion of the real riches represented by the American system. The sum total of these riches will be too fabulous for estimation, because they will be of such a nature that they may add to the riches of all the people of the United States, to say nothing of the people of other nations. Second, you will have demonstrated the soundness of the principle of going the extra mile by forcing the world to recognize you as the organizer of the first practical philosophy of individual achievement, an honor which is unusual, for no one before you has ever attempted to provide the people with such a philosophy, although the need for it has always existed. Third, the time will come when the unity of purpose for the American people will be disturbed because of the infiltration of foreign-born ideas which do not harmonize with the American way of life, and the people will be prepared, through causes beyond your control, for a dependable philosophy through which harmony may be restored. At this point, the wheel of fortune will turn up your number, and your big opportunity will have come. You will not have to induce people to accept the philosophy. They will do that voluntarily. I can see this opportunity already in the making. The seed of it may be found in the growing spirit of greed through which men endeavor to get something for nothing. The seed is gaining ground in the disturbing elements which have begun to threaten the harmony between industry and its workers. Subversive philosophies will find a convenient soil for the germination of this seed in the labor organizations. Here is where the discord will become first obvious. Professional agitators will work their way into the labor organizations and use them as a means of undermining American industry. The disturbance may result in some form of revolution that will strike at the very roots of the foundation stones of Americanism. But it will run its course, and the American people will recover from the shock. The people will begin to search for a way out, as the American people always do when overtaken by an emergency. Then your big opportunity will have arrived. The period of reconstruction of the American way of life will have begun, and the philosophy you will have organized by going the extra mile will become, of necessity, the means by which harmony will be restored. If you fail to see this picture as I have painted it, your failure will be mine also, because I have chosen you as my emissary to carry out the greatest assignment I have ever given to any man. If you do your work as I believe you can do it, the whole world will be richer because of your labor. Richer not only in material things, but richer in spiritual understanding, without which no form of riches can long endure. I hope you have recognized the fact that the philosophy of American achievement embodies not only the rules of material success, but also the principles expounded by the Master in the Sermon on the Mount. Whatsoever ye would that men should do unto you, do ye also unto them. Unless you comprehend this broader meaning of the philosophy, you will miss the greater possibilities of your mission. The people of the world are becoming spiritually bankrupt. They are turning away from the principles of Christianity to embrace the principles of paganism. They can be led back to the true principles of civilization by converting their greatest weakness into an irresistible power of attraction. That weakness is their desire for material things. Very well. The philosophy of American achievement provides the only known safe road to the accumulation of material riches, but it provides the means of spiritual recovery. Therefore, in giving the people that which they desire most, you will bestow along with it that which they need most. Surely you will not miss this point. Thus, in the picture I have drawn for you, you have a clear description of an opportunity such as no other American philosopher has ever possessed. This is an opportunity which may make you a great servant of the American people. Now I have a parting word of advice. Acquire humility of the heart. Do not become overimpressed with your own importance. Accept your mission as a privilege for which to be thankful, and not as an advantage of which to boast. Remembering always that the greatest among you shall be the servant of all.
No man is a free man until he learns to do his own thinking and gains the courage to act on his own personal initiative. Cultivate Creative Vision, Chapter 7. A philosopher said, "The imagination is the workshop of man wherein is fashioned the pattern of all his achievements." Another thinker described it as the workshop of the soul wherein man's hopes and desires are made ready for material expression. This chapter describes the methods by which some of the great leaders of America have, through the application of creative vision, made the American way of life the envy of the world. Observe the close relationship between this and the preceding chapter on organized individual endeavor. All forms of organized effort must be planned through creative vision. The two principles are inseparable.
Mr. Carnegie, you have said that creative vision is the seventh principle of individual achievement. Will you analyze this principle and describe how one may make practical use of it?
First of all, let us have a clear understanding of the meaning of the term creative vision, as we are here using it, by explaining that this is but another name for imagination. There are two types of imagination. One is known as synthetic imagination, and the other as creative imagination. Synthetic imagination consists of the act of combining recognized ideas, concepts, plans, facts, and principles in new arrangements. The old axiom that there is nothing new under the sun grew out of the fact that the majority of things which seem to be new are nothing but a rearrangement of that which is old. Practically all the patents recorded in the patent office are nothing more than old ideas which have been arranged in a new order or given a new use. Patents which do not come under this heading are known as basic patents, and they are the work of creative imagination. That is, they are based on newly created ideas which have not been previously used or recognized. Creative imagination has its source, as far as science has been able to determine, in the subconscious mind, wherein exists, through some power unknown to science, the ability to perceive and interpret basically new ideas. It is believed, by some, that the faculty of creative imagination truly is the workshop of the soul, through which man may contact and be guided by infinite intelligence. Of this, however, there is no conclusive evidence, save only that which is circumstantial. Let us therefore be content to accept the reality of creative imagination and make the best possible use of it without endeavoring to define its source. Of one fact we can be sure, and that is the undeniable reality of the existence of a faculty of the mind through which some men perceive and interpret new ideas never before known to man. Later we shall cite well-known examples of such ability. Moreover, we shall endeavor to describe how this ability may be developed and made to serve practical ends.
Which of the two types of imagination is used more often in the field of industry and in the ordinary walks of life?
Synthetic imagination is more commonly used. Creative imagination, as the name implies, is used only by those who, generally speaking, have attained to some form of leadership or unusual skill.
Will you mention examples of the application of both types of imagination, giving as many of the details as possible in order that the practical methods of application of these principles may be understood?
Let us take the work of Thomas A. Edison, for example. By studying his achievements, we shall see how he made use of both types of imagination, although he used the synthetic type more often. His first invention to attract worldwide attention was created by bringing together in a new combination two old and well-known principles. I refer to the incandescent electric lamp, the perfection of which was attained only after Mr. Edison had tried more than 10,000 different combinations of old ideas without satisfactory results.
Do you mean, Mr. Carnegie, that Mr. Edison had the persistence to keep on trying in the face of 10,000 failures?
I mean just that. And I may as well here call your attention to the fact that men with a keen sense of imagination seldom quit trying until they find the answer to their problems. As I was saying, Mr. Edison perfected the incandescent electric lamp by combining two well-known principles in a new way. The first of these principles was the established fact that by applying electric energy to both ends of a piece of wire, a resistance is established through which the wire becomes heated to a white glow that will produce light. That principle had been known long before the time of Mr. Edison's experiments with the electric lamp. But the trouble arose from the fact that no way had been found to control the heat. Perhaps the facts would be better understood if I said that no form of metal or other substance had been found that would carry the necessary amount of heat to make a satisfactory light for more than a few seconds. The intense head of the electricity soon burned out the metal. After trying every known substance he could find, without discovering anything that would serve the desired purpose, Mr. Edison stumbled upon another well-known principle which proved to be the answer to his problem. I say he stumbled upon it, but perhaps that is not the precise way the principle came to his attention. Of that I shall have more to say later on. At any rate, there came into his mind the well-known principle by which charcoal is produced, and he recognized in it the answer to the problem that had caused him more than 10,000 failures. Briefly explained, charcoal is produced by placing a pile of wood on the ground, setting it on fire, and then covering the whole pile with dirt. The dirt permits just enough air to pass through to the fire to keep it alive and smoldering, but not enough to enable the fire to blaze. The smoldering process continues until the wood becomes charred through and through, leaving the log intact in the form of a substance known as charcoal. The reason the wood does not burn up entirely, as it would if left in the open air, is the fact that the dirt allows only enough oxygen to reach the fire, through the intake of air, to produce the smoldering condition, but not enough to cause the wood to burn up completely. You, of course, learned in the study of physics that where there is no oxygen, there can be no fire, that by controlling the inflow of oxygen, the amount of heat of fire can be controlled proportionately. Mr. Edison had known of this principle long before he began experimenting with the electric lamp, but not until after he had gone through thousands of tests did he think of it as being the principle for which he was searching. As soon as this principle was recognized as the one for which he was searching, he went into his laboratory, placed a coiled wire in a bottle, pumped out all the air, sealed the bottle with wax, applied the electric energy to the two ends of the wire, and lo, the world's first successful incandescent electric lamp was born. The crudely constructed lamp burned for more than 8 hours. Of course, it is obvious as to what happened. By placing the wire in a vacuum that contained no oxygen, it could be heated sufficiently to cause it to produce a light without its burning out entirely, as it had done when left in the open air. That same principle is used in the making of all incandescent electric lamps today, although the method has been greatly refined until the modern electric lamp is much more efficient than it was when Edison first discovered how to control the heat. Now, let us go back to the question as to how Mr. Edison came to think of combining these two old principles in a new way. I said he stumbled upon the idea of using the charcoal principle as a means of controlling the heat of the electric energy. But that is not exactly the way this idea occurred to him. Here begins, then, the entry into the picture of the principle of creative imagination. By his repetition of thought in connection with his problem, carried on over a long period of time through thousands of experiments, Mr. Edison either consciously or unconsciously charged his subconscious mind with a clear picture of his problem. And by some queer power which no one understands, his subconscious mind handed over to him the solution to his problem, in the form of a hunch that caused him to think of the charcoal principle. In describing the experience many years afterward, Mr. Edison said that when the hunch came to him, he recognized it immediately as being the missing link for which he had been searching. Moreover, he felt assured it would work even before he tested it. He made the further significant statement that when the idea of using the charcoal principle flashed into his mind, it brought with it a feeling of assurance of its suitability, such as did not accompany any one of the other thousands of similar ideas he had tested through synthetic imagination. From this statement, we may draw the conclusion that the subconscious mind not only has the power to create the solution to problems, but it also has a means of forcing one to recognize the solution when it is presented to the conscious mind.
From your last remark, Mr. Carnegie, I draw the conclusion that persistence was of the essence of Mr. Edison's success in the discovery of the solution to his problem.
Yes, and some other factors, too. First of all, he began his research with definiteness of purpose, thus applying the first of the 17 principles of individual achievement. He knew the nature of his problem, but equally as important as this, he was determined to find its solution. Therefore, he backed his definiteness of purpose with an obsessional desire for its attainment. Obsessional desire is the state of mind which, as you will recall, serves to clear the mind of fear and doubt and self-imposed limitations, thereby opening the way for that state of mind known as faith. By his refusal to accept defeat through more than 10,000 failures, Mr. Edison prepared his mind for the application of faith. We may reasonably assume that his faith placed him in contact with infinite intelligence, wherein is known all facts and the solution to all problems which are capable of solution.
Were all of Mr. Edison's inventions created through the joint application of creative imagination and synthetic imagination, as in the case of the incandescent electric lamp?
Not by any means. The majority of his inventions were created solely through the aid of synthetic imagination, by the trial and error method of experimentation. But he did complete one invention solely through the aid of creative imagination, and as far as I know, this was the only invention he perfected through this principle alone. I have reference to the phonograph. That was basically a new idea. No one before Edison, as far as is known, had ever produced a machine that would record and reproduce the vibrations of sound.
What technique did Mr. Edison use in the application of creative imagination in perfecting the talking machine?
The technique was very simple. He impressed his subconscious mind with the idea of a talking machine and there passed over to his conscious mind a perfect plan for the building of such a machine.
Do you mean that Edison relied on creative imagination entirely?
Yes, entirely. And one of the strange features of this particular invention of Mr. Edison's is the fact that the plan which his subconscious mind yielded to him worked almost from the first attempt to apply it. The idea of how such a machine could be produced flashed into Edison's mind. He sat down then and there and drew a rough picture of the machine, handed it to his model maker and asked him to produce the machine, and in a matter of hours it had been finished, tested, and lo, it worked. Of course, the machine was crude, but it was sufficient to prove that Edison's creative imagination had not failed him.
You say that Mr. Edison impressed his subconscious mind with the idea of a talking machine. Now, how did he go about doing this, and how long did it require before his subconscious mind handed over to him the working principle of the machine?
I am not sure that Mr. Edison stated exactly how long he had been thinking of such a machine before his subconscious mind picked up his thoughts and translated them into a perfected plan, but I am under the impression it was not more than a few weeks at most, perhaps not more than a few days. His method of impressing his subconscious mind with his desire consisted of the simple procedure of converting that desire into an obsession. That is, the thought of a machine that would record and reproduce sound became the dominating thought of his mind. He focused his mind on it through concentration of his interest and made it the major occupant of his mind from day to day until this form of autosuggestion penetrated his subconscious mind and registered a clear picture of his desire.
Is that the way one connects the conscious mind with the subconscious, Mr. Carnegie?
Yes, that is the simplest known method. You see, therefore, why I have emphasized the importance of intensifying one's desires until they become obsessional. A deep, burning desire is picked up by the subconscious and acted upon much more definitely and quickly than an ordinary desire. A mere wish appears to make no impression on the subconscious. Many people become confused as to the difference between a wish and a burning desire, which has been stimulated into obsessional proportions by the repetition of thought in connection with the desire.
If I understand you correctly, Mr. Carnegie, the element of repetition is important. Why?
Because repetition of thought creates thought habits in the mind, which cause the mind to go right on working on an idea without one's conscious effort. Apparently, the subconscious concerns itself first with those thoughts which have become habits, and especially if the thoughts have been strongly emotionalized by a deep and burning desire for their realization.
Then anyone may make use of creative imagination by the simple process of charging his subconscious mind with definite desires?
Yes. There is nothing to hinder anyone from using this principle. But you must remember that practical results are obtained only by those who have gained discipline over their thought habits through the process of concentration of interest and desire. Fleeting thoughts, which come and go intermittently, and mere wishes, which are about the extent of the average person's thinking, make no impression whatsoever on the subconscious mind. I will have more to say on this subject when we discuss self-discipline.
Author's note. The subject of habit and its effect on individual achievement will be covered thoroughly in another chapter of this book under the title of Cosmic Habit Force, a newly discovered law of nature which promises to become of the utmost importance in connection with the power of thought. Nothing was known of this law at the time Mr. Carnegie was analyzing this subject, although his description of the manner in which the subconscious mind can be reached and influenced harmonizes perfectly with the nature of cosmic habit force.
Will you mention some additional examples of the practical application of the two types of imagination?
Well, take the experience of Henry Ford in connection with his perfection of a self-propelled vehicle, for example. The idea of such a vehicle was first suggested to him by a steam-propelled tractor that was being used to haul a threshing machine. From the first time that he saw the tractor, his mind began to work on the idea of a horseless buggy. At first, he used only the principle of synthetic imagination by centering his mind on ways and means of converting the steam tractor into a rapid-moving vehicle for the transportation of passengers. The idea became obsessional with him, and it had the effect of conveying his burning desire to his subconscious mind, where it was picked up and acted upon. The action of the subconscious mind suggested to him the use of an internal combustion engine to take the place of the steam engine, and he went to work immediately on the creation of such an engine. Of course, he had the experiments of other men in connection with internal combustion gas engines as a guide, but his problem was to find a way to convey the power of the engine to the wheels of a vehicle. He kept his mind charged with his major purpose until, step by step, his subconscious mind presented him with ideas with which he perfected the planetary system of power transmission, which enabled him to perfect his first working model of an automobile, Model T.
Will you describe the major factors which entered into the modus operandi of Mr. Ford's mind while he was perfecting the automobile?
That will be very easy. And when I describe them, you will have a clear understanding of the working principles used by all successful men, as well as a clear picture of the Ford mind, viz. A. Mr. Ford was motivated by a definite purpose, which is the first step in all individual achievements. B. He stimulated his purpose into an obsession by concentrating his thoughts upon it. C. He converted his purpose into definite plans through the principle of organized individual endeavor, and put his plans into action with unabating persistence. D. He made use of the master mind principle, first by the harmonious aid of his wife, and secondly by gaining counsel from others who had experimented with internal combustion engines and methods of power transmission. Still later, of course, when he began to produce automobiles for sale, he made a still more extensive use of the mastermind principle by allying himself with the Dodge brothers and other mechanics and engineers skilled in the sort of mechanical problems he had to solve. E. Back of all this effort was the power of applied faith, which he acquired as the result of his intense desire for achievement in connection with his definite major purpose.
Summarized briefly, Mr. Ford's success was due to his having adopted a definite major purpose, which he fanned into a white-heat flame of obsession, thus leading to the stimulation of both the faculties of synthetic imagination and creative imagination.
That tells the story in one sentence. That part of the story that should be emphasized is the fact that Mr. Ford moved with persistence. At first, he met with one form of defeat after another. One of his major difficulties was lack of capital with which to carry on his research before he perfected his automobile. After that came a still greater difficulty in connection with procuring the necessary operating capital to produce his automobiles in quantity production. Then followed a series of difficulties, such as disagreements with the members of his mastermind group, and other similar problems, all of which called for persistence and determination. These qualities Mr. Ford possesses, and I think we might say he owes his success to his ability to know exactly what he wants and his capacity to stand by his wants with unrelenting persistence. If one single quality stands out in the Ford character above all others, it is his capacity for persistence. Let me remind you again that definiteness of purpose, backed with a form of persistence that assumes the proportion of an obsession, is the greatest of all stimulants of both the synthetic and the creative forms of imagination. The mind of man is provided with a power which forces the subconscious mind to accept and to act upon obsessional desires that are definitely planned.
Will you now cite some other examples of the practical application of imagination?
Take, for example, Dr. Alexander Graham Bell's research in connection with the modern telephone. Here we have an example of the use of creative imagination, for Bell's invention was basically new. Let us say that he, like Edison, stumbled upon the principle that made the telephone practical while searching for some mechanical device with which he could create a hearing aid for his wife, whose hearing was impaired. Here again, we find a man who was inspired by a definite purpose which assumed obsession proportions. His keen sympathy for his wife was the factor that gave obsessional force to his purpose. In this case, as in all others where men give obsessional proportions to their desires, a definite motive was behind his desire. Motive is the beginning of all desires. Through a long period of research that is too involved in details for description here, Dr. Bell's subconscious mind finally presented him with an idea which served his purpose. It became known to the scientific world as Bell's experiment, the substance of which was this. A ray of light is cast upon a plate of selenium, which sends the ray back to another plate some distance away of the same metal. This latter communicates with a galvanic battery to which a telephone is attached. The words uttered behind the first plate are distinctly heard through the telephone at the end of the second plate. The ray of light, accordingly, has served as a telephone wire. The sound waves have become transferred into light waves, the latter into galvanic waves, and these have become, once again, sound waves. Thus, a basically new principle for conveying sound waves was uncovered. It has been claimed that the principle, in part, was suggested to Dr. Bell by the experiments of a man by the name of Dolbear. There was a lawsuit over the priority of right to the principle, but Mr. Dolbear lost the suit, and Dr. Bell was declared to have been the discoverer of the working principle of the modern telephone. At any rate, Dr. Bell's desire for a mechanical hearing aid for his wife, backed by a persistent search for such a device, led to the discovery of the principle he needed. It must be remembered that the subconscious mind makes use of every practical means available for revealing knowledge to those seeking it with obsessional desire. It performs no miracles, but it makes intelligent use of all practical media available in carrying out its purpose.
Now, Mr. Carnegie, let us get away from the field of invention and see how the principle of imagination may be applied in the less complicated fields of endeavor.
Very well. Take, for example, the first great mail-order house that was established in the United States. Here we have a fine example of synthetic imagination applied to merchandising. A telegraph operator with whom I formerly worked found that he had extra time on his hands, which he could not use in connection with his duties as a railroad telegrapher. Being a man with an inquisitive type of mind, he began to search for something he could do that would keep him occupied and at the same time add to his income. Here again the question of motive entered the picture, the motive of financial gain. After having turned the matter over in his mind for several months, he envisioned a profitable outlet for his efforts by using the idle telegraph line for the purpose of selling watches to his fellow operators in his division. So he ordered half a dozen watches at wholesale rates and began to offer them for sale. The idea caught fire from the very beginning. In a very short time, he had sold all six of the watches. Then, spurred on by his success, his imagination began to expand until he took on other items of jewelry. Everything went well, and he was doing a land office business until his superintendent found out what he was up to and fired him on the spot. Every adversity brings with it the seed of an equivalent benefit. Out of this telegrapher's adversity was born the first great mail-order house. He switched his method of selling from telegraphy to the mails, using at first a mimeographed catalog of his wares. Moreover, he added others outside the field of telegraphers to his list of prospective buyers, mainly people living in the villages and rural districts. In a little while, his business had grown to where he could afford a printed catalog, illustrated with pictures of his merchandise. From that point on, the story is known to millions of people throughout the United States who now purchase merchandise from the mail-order house he established. He finally took a partner into the business with him, thereby making use of the mastermind principle. This partner proved to be a veritable goldmine because he had a keen sense of advertising. Several years later, the business was sold out to a corporation at a price which made its owners multimillionaires. That was the beginning of mail-order merchandising on a large scale. Now, there was nothing very mysterious about this man's success. He simply put his mind to work on a definite purpose and kept behind that purpose until it made him rich. He did not create anything new. He merely put an old idea to new use. In this manner, many of the great fortunes have been accumulated.
If I understand you correctly, Mr. Carnegie, the telegraph operator applied only the principle of synthetic imagination.
Yes, that is it. You see, he did nothing except apply the principle of merchandising in a new way. But do not forget that this is about all.